Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDilling and I'm so delighted to be here today with the amazing Candace Fox.
Hi, thanks for having me. I love coming here.
Oh, we love when you come to visit us. Mostly because it means you've got a new book out and I get to read it.
It's getting more frequent. It is getting very fast. It's 3 novels a year at the moment, which is actually, I'm finding it a good pace. Keeps the pressure on.
Not many people can pull that off.
I know. I just have been to a couple of literary festivals, one in New York and one in Harrogate in England, and people were horrified. Everyone from Lee Child to Val McDermid was horrified. They were like,
that you were doing 3 books.
Yeah, they were like, no. I think there was a little bit of like terror in them that would get around, and then their publishers would be like, so do you think you could maybe do this a bit faster? I don't know.
What do you think it is that it allows you to be able to write these so quickly?
I just think I've been doing it since I was a kid, so I can go fast, you know. It just is practice, I think. I would put out thousands upon thousands of words when I was a kid, and I just got that fast. I can put down 1,000 words in an hour.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how long roughly per book?
So 4 months. If they're exactly 4 months each. But I'm always planning one and writing one and editing one at the same time.
Do you think that's why? Because we've had a few authors. I know Aaron Blaby once said he can't work on one thing at a time. It has to be, I think he has 5 things going.
Yeah.
Because it helps his creative process. Would you say that's true for you?
Yeah, I think so. I can't write more than one at a time. I tried to do that once. I wrote Never Never with Jim and Crimson Lake at the same time, and they both turned out very successful books, but I nearly went nuts. Like, I couldn't sleep at night, and I was doing weird things in the middle of the night. Like, my husband had come out, and I'm, you know, standing at the windows staring out at the stars, and he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know, just think about stuff.
So you gotta avoid that.
It was funny. I was sitting there on the couch this morning staring at my coffee. He said, what are you thinking about? I said, crime scenes. And he was like, oh. And that's like, that's as far as it goes. You know. What are you thinking about? Autopsies. Oh, okay.
Good on you. Thoughts that must go through your head as a crime writer.
Yeah. It's a weird life. It's a weird life. You get to do weird things. You know.
Well, you're actually here today to talk about Liar Liar.
Yes.
Which is the 3rd book in the Detective Harriet Bligh series that you write with James Patterson.
Yes.
So can you, for the people listening, just tell them a little bit about this Harry story?
So try not to do any spoilers, which is really hard with this one because it's a revenge book. So something has happened in the previous books which leads Harry to seek revenge against the serial killer, Regan Banks. And she is not the kind of person who really likes to go by the book. So in pursuing him, she is dropping her role as a police officer and going rogue. And so all her cop friends are like, well, not all her cop friends because she's pretty unpopular in her job, but her 2 or 3 cop friends are like, no, 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 please don't go and kill him because then you'll go to jail. And so
everyone else is like, we'll arrest you.
Yeah, we'll arrest you. So she is being pursued by the police at the same time that she is pursuing Regan. So it's kind of it's a double cat and mouse chase down the south coast of Australia. So in the books, we're just Jim and I are just trying to detail places in Australia that aren't sort of the metropolitan cities, because I think that Sydney has been kind of overrepresented in crime fiction. And when we and I say that as someone who's written 3 books about Sydney, so I'm allowed to. But yeah, Jim likes to see parts of Australia that aren't necessarily, you know, full frontal in the consciousness. Yeah, yeah. So it was fun. Loads of fun to write. Very fast. Very fast write.
It's a very fast read. I feel like this is true of all your books, but there is also, when you're writing with James Patterson, it's like shorter chapters and there's no point at which you can stop reading, because it's almost like every chapter, it's not a cliffhanger, but every chapter leaves you on a little
A little hook, yeah.
Yeah.
A little tail.
I found that I just couldn't stop once I started. And I mean, it's always the case, but it just always fascinates me how you... Is it... Like, how do you do that?
Is it deliberate?
Well, I mean, no, of course it's deliberate, but is it hard?
Like, is it hard? Yeah. It's hard because sometimes you want to do that thing. It's really easy to break a chapter in half by having someone just go, and then I felt a presence in the room and I gasped. And then I realized it was the waitress coming in and bringing coffee. Like, you know,
I mean,
like,
never like that.
It's a cheat. Yeah. I mean, so I try not to do that, but, yeah, it is difficult. And writing with Jim, I write in his style as well, which is the short chapters, and there's no real time for reflection and people, you know, thinking and recalling things from the past. And I like to have multiple timelines and multiple character perspectives sometimes in my own novels, and Jim just doesn't do that. And so... Yeah, it's hard. When I wrote my first couple of novels with him, he was like, "You're a really funny person, but my books really aren't this funny." So we've got to cut some of the humor out to keep it tense and tighter. And he sort of stopped doing that. So they're getting funnier and funnier, but also darker and darker. And
this one does feel like it's gone to a darker place.
Yeah,
but it's true. There is so much humor. Just from, I mean, it's the characters, and we've got to know them now over three books.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, there's a lot of sort of fan favourites. Everyone loves Tox, for
example. Tox Barnes is a massive heartthrob.
Yeah.
And I realised, I have tried to make characters heartthrobs before, like Ted Concaffey in my own series has turned into a bit of a heartthrob, but not like Tox Barnes. Like, readers are like, "Oh, damn, he is hot." You know,
there's something about him.
And I frequently talk about how shaggy and unkempt and smelly he is, and he wears a dusty leather jacket. Like, he sounds like every girl's worst nightmare. Can you imagine, like, what his apartment looks like? Dirty and, you know, beer bottles and coffee mugs and...
But somehow,
everybody want, all the ladies want to go there. I don't know what it is, but... You know, whatever works. Yeah. So he has a piece in this book as well, because Jim and I came up with Tox when we wrote Black and Blue, which was actually, we wrote that after Never Never. So he wasn't in Never Never. So people who have started at 50-50 and they go backwards into Never Never are like, "Where is he?" You know, and they want to promise that he's going to be around. So I'll let you know. Ladies of Australia, Tox Barnes is in this book. So might have to wait for him to show up, but he is around.
He has a good book.
Yeah.
I like it. I think he's got some great stuff going on.
Yeah.
And you've also, I mean, would it be fair to say, like, again, I've got a tiptoe around spoilers, but there's been a kind of overarching story and, like, a lot of stuff kind of is resolved in a way here.
Yeah.
But there's going to be more books.
Yeah.
And so do you think that the next few books are going to be a different sort of
feel.
Arc? Yeah.
Yes. I definitely wanted to resolve the whole Regan, because what I don't want is that nemesis character who keeps coming back.
Like Moriarty.
Moriarty. Yeah, I like Moriarty. He's cool. But he does lose his... effect after a while.
Yes.
And then if a villain is around for long enough, I think you start to sympathise with them as well and maybe like them, because you learn more about their personality. And so I had to get rid of Regan before people start liking him, because I don't want him to be liked. And so, yeah, there will be new villains coming up. But then, yeah, something happens in the end of Liar Liar, which sets a new tone, at least going into the next one.
Which is very, it's really hard to talk about without giving
anything away.
It's hard
to talk about, yeah.
But yeah, the way this one ends just had me ravenous for the next.
Oh, good.
Like, just the situation where things end up is fascinating.
It promises violence.
It does. And there's never a shortage, really.
There's never a shortage, but it's kind of like it's become a kind of guarantee. you know, at the end of this novel, it's like, there's violence coming.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, oh, good. You know, just in case you were
doubting that there might be more.
There's a little bit of every book ends with Harry being seriously pissed off about something.
She just does pissed off so well, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's really a great space for her to be in.
Yes, it's good for me to write when I'm in a really bad mood. I'm not sure how Jim accesses that pissed off female when he takes his bits as well, but, you know, he manages to do it somehow.
She's full of fire and one of my favorites. I can never really decide. I've said to you before, you've got multiple series, and every time one comes out, I'm like, no, yeah, this is definitely my favorite one. Like, definitely it is. But then the next one comes out, and getting back with those characters and stuff, I honestly, it always just ends up being a tie. But at the moment, it's Harry, because that's what I've just read.
Oh, good. That's good. It would be so fun to see them all in a room together.
Oh, my God.
At a party or something, or a bar, just hanging out. I'd love to see, for example, how Harry would interact with Amanda.
Harry and Amanda would be insane.
Insanity. And then, like, Eden walks over.
Oh, my God.
She's like, you two idiots.
Oh, that's just my favorite, like, girl gang.
Girl gang. Yeah.
I would love to read that.
Yeah, big mashup. It would be fun to write a big mashup.
Now, you were just telling us previous to starting this podcast that you had a very, very interesting day, which you didn't tell us the details of, but teased a few details. Can I ask you, tell us about this day you had recently that was where you met a lot of interesting people.
Sure, I'll do just that. well, I was in the US. I've been in the US for a year. And while I was over there, I did all the touristy sort of stuff, you know, like I went to New York, Central Park and California, hit the beaches, got a good tan, that sort of thing. But I did very crime writery sort of things as well. So Jim and I are going to be writing about people who are incarcerated coming up. And so I started writing to these people in prisons, and I thought I might as well go straight for the top. So I wrote to a serial killer who is incarcerated on death row in San Quentin. And I wrote to him basically because he's the worst living serial killer that I can think of is still alive. Oh, and I told him that. You're dying. I wrote to him. When I started writing to him, I thought I'm just going to say everything straight. I'm sorry, I'm just going to have a sip of water.
Oh, no. I'll just stay here on tenterhooks, desperate to hear the next part of this story.
That's one of those things where you start telling the story and it's like, so I met a serial killer the other day, and then you take a bite of your burger. You just munch your burger for 5 minutes while everyone's like, anyway, so yeah, I wrote to him, and I was going to leave him under no illusions because I thought, I don't want to manipulate this person into telling me things. I'm just going to say it straight. So I wrote to him, and I was like, look, I want to come and talk to you about these bloody murders that you did and why you did them, and you're just about the worst person I've ever heard of in my life, and can we sit down and talk about that? And he was like, yeah, sure.
Whoa.
No probs. And so we exchanged, you know, not in those exact words, but those were the things.
I'm paraphrasing.
And so we exchanged 10 letters, and then I got visitation approval to go and visit him in San Quentin death row. And so the craziest, I mean, this guy is a violent serial killer. He's responsible for the deaths of a bunch of young ladies in the 70s. And so I get all the way through security, 3 levels of security, and there's bloody guard dogs in this. And you go into San Quentin's big old stone prison. And I get in there, finally get all the way in there, nobody tells you what to do. So I'm standing there because everyone, if you're going to visit somebody on death row, I suppose you've done it a few times and they just assume you'll know what to do.
But everyone's got a first time, right?
I know, you'd think, right?
There'd be some level of instruction.
So I was just standing there and I saw this guard and I said, oh, excuse me, I'm here to visit so-and-so, and I'm not going to say his name in public because
there's so many
different problems with people knowing it out there in public. But so I said, I'm here to see so-and-so. And he said, oh, yeah, he's going to be in that cage there in a few minutes. And he points to this cage.
Oh,
it's like a shark cage. It's sort of 2 meters by 2 meters, and it goes all the way up to the ceiling, and it's got steel mesh on the outside of it. On the inside of it is this bulletproof plexiglass up to about eye level. And I said, okay. He said, he's not here yet, but he's going to be in there in a couple of minutes. And I said to the guard, all right, and where will I be? And he said, in that cage.
What?
Yeah. He goes, you're going to be in that cage.
What? What?
And I was like, okay.
What's the cage for?
Well,
isn't it? No.
You're like, no. That's what I was work? Like. I was like, okay, well, this is unexpected, but okay. So I didn't protest. So they lead him out in cuffs. And this is a guy I've seen, you know, in court photos and documentaries and stuff. And I was like, oh, my God, there he is. And they walk him right past me and they put him in the cage. And he's got cuffs on. He's got handcuffs, hands cuffed behind his back. And I thought, all right, that's okay. He's cuffed. So I get into the cage with him and we sit down and do the pleasantries. Oh, hi, how are you? Oh, thanks for talking to me, this sort of thing. So the guard shuts the door. And then he stands up and puts his hands through a hole in the door and they uncuff him.
Are you kidding me?
They uncuff him and then they padlock the door and then they walk away.
This does not seem the way it should be.
No.
I have problems with this.
I have many problems with this. And so...
So what was going through your mind at this point?
I was like, where's the guard going? Why is he walking away? But he had other things to do. He was walking up and down. And there were...
He's a busy guy. He just left you in the cage with the serial killer.
I was just... So he sat down. He's like, oh, how are you going and all this? And I said to him, you know, I'm a little... I've got to be honest. I'm a little bit surprised that we're in this situation together with the whole shark cage and the no cuffs thing. And he goes, yeah, it's a full contact visit. Didn't you know that? And I said... No, I didn't know that. It wasn't on any of the paperwork. And he goes, yeah, yeah, we can touch each other if we want. And so he puts his hand out to shake my hand.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, oh, do you shake the serial killer's hand? Is that the done thing? I didn't want to offend him, though, obviously, in case he lunged at me and tried to bite my face off, like Hannibal Lecter style. So I thought, all right, I'll shake his hand. And I shook his hand. And I was like, oh, this is the biggest cliche ever. But his hand was ice cold.
I can't handle this.
And so we were in there for 5 hours together in the shark cage and we kept making jokes about, we can touch each other. And I was like, oh, serial killer germs. And he'd put his finger out and I'd touch his finger with my index finger like, oh.
Oh, my God.
It was insanity. And the guards were like walking up and down and I was like, oh. I said to him, I said, so what happens if – you lunge at me, and I didn't say, and try to bite my face off. I didn't want to make any suggestions. I said, what happens if you attack me, if you lunge at me? And he said, well, I don't know if this is true or not, because 90% of everything he says is dead lies. But he says, if you look up in the ceiling there, there's a little triangle cut out of the ceiling. And I said, yeah. And he said, up there is a rifle man, and if I lunge at you, he'll just shoot me. And I said, well, I have some problems with that.
Uh-huh.
Because he's going to have to shoot you through this steel mesh. So I hope he gets through the mesh and it doesn't ricochet and then kill me. And then I said, I hope he shoots you and not me because I can imagine we'll be in a ferocious tangle because I'm not going to just wear it if you lunge at me. I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go back at you. And then I said, and then there's the problem of you getting shot in the head, you know, like right in front of me kind of thing. I was like, I have multiple complaints with this.
Oh, so would I.
And then I said, once we got through that, I said to him, what happens if I lunge at you? And he said, I'll probably deserve it. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right.
Whoa.
But he was, because I was sizing him up, I was thinking, I'm going to have to go this guy if he goes me. And I thought, I think I'll go, right? And then I was like, a little bit like Harry in Liar Liar.
I was just going to say.
I'm putting my fiction into practice here. But, you know, it was crazy because I had a pencil as well. I had a pencil with me because I had brought these maps in because two of his victims were never found. And so I said, you know, we discussed it in the letters and I said, if you wouldn't mind showing me on these maps where you dump these two ladies. He said, yeah, yeah, sure. And so I was holding the pencil and I've gone, could you maybe on this map show me? This is after a couple of hours. I didn't go straight into this.
Oh, my God, he took the pencil.
And so he took the pencil out of my hand and I was like, oh, God, don't stab me with that, you know.
I'm literally on the edge of my seat.
I know.
Like, while you're talking, I've moved to the edge of my seat.
it was crazy. And you know the craziest thing about the whole situation is that some fans of mine will know my mother, the notorious Ocean Mermaid. My mum changed her name to Ocean Mermaid a few years ago, legally. Like, that's what her name is on her driver's license. And it's, you know, it's probably one of the more normal things she's ever done. But the whole time I was in the US, she was nagging me about, you're in New York. I know what New York is like. It's dangerous. Stay on the phone with me until you get into the hotel room. She's nagging me about this and she's... and everything. And I said to her, I'm going to go and visit a serial killer. And then after the visiting of the serial killer, I said, they locked me in a shark cage with him for 5 hours. And she said, I am so jealous. She's like, don't talk to me about it. Why can't I go and visit a serial killer? Oh, my God, I'm so jealous. And I'm like, you don't let me walk down the street in New York, 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the broad daylight, but you just... you're just dead jealous that I've gone into a shark cage with a violent serial killer. It was...
interesting thought process she must have on that.
She's a strange woman.
Story blows my mind.
I know, doesn't it?
I honestly don't think I would be brave enough. Like...
you were just going, nah.
I just think I would want to and I'd maybe get all the way there. But when I saw the cage, I think I would have...
It was every step of the whole process of knowing him has been very different. Like, from the very first letter, I was writing his name. We'll call him, like, Tony, I guess. His name's not Tony, but say his name was Tony. Mm-hmm. I was writing the first letter, I was like, Dear Tony.
Oh, God.
To Tony. To whom it may concern. Like,
Tony.
do you write Dear Tony? So I wrote Dear Tony. And then... you know, he sent me a bunch of paraphernalia from inside the jail, and one of them was a menu from the commissary, and on the menu was all this highlighted stuff. And I said to my husband, I think he wants me to – he had mentioned it in the letter, but I said, I think he wants me to send him some commissary. And I was like, oh, does he deserve the commissary? Like, what if the victim's families knew that I was sending him commissary? Oh, and then I thought, oh, but he's been so generous talking to me. Maybe I'll just send him the essentials. Like, he needed some new shower shoes and he needed some medical stuff. And I thought, okay, I'll just send him that. And then I saw that he likes red velvet cupcakes, and they had the red velvet cupcakes. And I'm like, do I send him the cupcakes?
What a
does
question.
It mean anything if I send him the cupcakes? They're just cupcakes, you know. But it was such an emotional, the whole... and so... when we were in the cage together, it was like, yeah, do I shake his hand or not or whatever? And then before they were going to put the cuffs back on for the end of the meeting, we were both standing there in the cage and I was like, oh, I don't think you hug him. Like, oh, I wouldn't want to hug him. But do I shake his hand again or do I – what do you do? Do you say thanks, have a nice day? Or,
oh, my God, what did you do?
I just kind of patted him on the shoulder. I said, thank you so much for talking to me today. He was like, yeah, no problem. Anyway, one of the things that he does is he sends these, he makes these cards, like humorous cards, and he made me one. And they pop up, and so he sent it to me in the mail, and on the front it said, just a little note to say, ... And then I was like, oh, my God, what's going to happen? And so I opened it up and it's this clown, this, like, scary clown, and he's got a banner and it goes, thank you. And it said, thank you for your friendship. And I was like,
this is
out
of control. I can't even believe what I'm hearing.
It's insane.
Your life is amazing.
No, I know. Well, see, that happened. And then the second time I went to visit him, I met the president in the evening.
So... okay, first of all, I'm still processing
this amazing segue. The segue from serial killer in the morning.
And then you went again to visit him. How many visits in person?
I had two.
Two.
But that's all I had time for. But the second one was a bit unexpected because Jim had called me up and he said, oh, I'm going to be in San Jose and you're only in Los Angeles. Come up and have dinner with the president and I. And I was like, all right.
Oh, my Lord.
And so I'd written to... Tony, and I'd said, I'm going to be there unexpectedly. So you want to, I don't know, hang out in the morning, and then in the evening we'll go and have dinner with the president.
So, what a day.
I know, right? And in between there I patted a very nice dog.
Well, that was, that's obviously the highlight.
The highlight of the day.
excuse me, I'm just losing my mind.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Is that something that lots of... Is this what crime writers do? Is it really unusual to be given that kind of access, or is it sort of something that happens, like with crime writers?
Anyone can go and do it. Like these chicks that I was talking to, one of them was a physio, and she said, I'm so jealous. I want to go and visit a serial killer. And I said, you can. There's nothing stopping you. You just pick which one you want. And then you write to them and you say, can I put, you know, just look up their address on the internet. I don't know how it works in Australia. I've never written to an Australian inmate because I don't want them to maybe turn up on my doorstep.
Too close. Yeah.
But he's on death row. He's never going to get out. And so you just look up their address and then you write to them and you say, hey, can I come visit you? And probably if they're a psychopathic male, they'll say, yeah, sure.
Oh, my God.
And then you just get approval. And when to get approval, you write in, you say, can I visit this inmate? And then they look up, have you been visiting any other inmates? Because they'll probably go, oh, we don't want people passing messages in between.
Oh, I get it, yeah.
And then do you have a criminal record? They're interested in that. And so if you don't have either of those, you can go visit. But as a crime writer... people raise their eyebrows about it less.
I'm actually like, thank you. You've broken me.
I've broken you. But I have done things like that in my life, like going visiting the scenes of murder or going and talking to cops about dead people or whatever, and people just expect that.
That is just...
when you're a crime writer. It's just... it's research.
I actually, like, I don't even have a cop.
I'm dying. Like,
that story has just completely blown me away.
Oh. So I'll talk about the president. I'll give you a little break.
Yeah, give me some recovery time.
So in the afternoon, yeah, the afternoon of that very day, Jim had said, come to an event. And it was he... James Patterson and Bill Clinton talking about their book, The President is Missing. And so it was at this big arena in San Jose, which is about an hour's drive south of San Francisco. And so I caused a bit of a furor when I, if that's the word, turned up, because I walked in, I walked to the special entrance that I was supposed to go to, and there was this cocktail party before, you know, the event, and there's about 30 people invited to that bit. And so I turned up and I said, oh, this is a Secret Service woman. She's in a suit. And they're all standing around, like just like you see in the movies, the black suits and the little earpiece. And I said, oh, this is going to sound odd, which probably wasn't the best way to start it. But I said, this is going to sound odd, but I'm supposed to be here, but I don't have a ticket. Everybody else has got tickets, so I don't have one because I'm Jim's friend. I'm like his co-author and his friend. And he just invited me to this thing over the phone. And so I'm like his Australian connection, you know, and I really am meant to be here, but I'm not going to be, like, on your list. And this Secret Service lady is like, okay. She's like, I'm going to ask you to stand over here, please. And I'll be right back. And she just walked away, and I could just see the Secret Service being like, red alert! There's a strange Australian woman says she's meant to be here, doesn't have a ticket. You know, and everyone's freaking out. And so it took them about 10 minutes to sort it out, and they were all pointing at me and, like, going on their earpieces and trying to figure out who the hell I was and all this. So eventually they let me in anyway, and... So I went hanging out with Jim and Bill, and then Jim's wife Sue and I are quite good friends, so she dragged me out of the queue and we just went into the back area behind the scenes. And so there were so many Secret Service there. When we were at the soiree, there were 30 guests and 21 Secret Service in the room.
Oh, my God.
So if anyone made a false move, all of them would have, like, stacked on It would have been amazing. So it was like a little bit tense. But not only was there Secret Service in the black suits with little ear pieces, there were Secret Service in blue suits with little ear pieces. And then there were like cops, patrol cops in black uniforms. And then there were sheriff's people in tan uniforms. And then there were SWAT guys with like tactical vests and helmets. So there were five different types of dudes. And they obviously had been briefed on who Jim was and who Bill was.
But you were unknown.
But I was unknown, and so was Sue, Jim's wife. So we were walking maybe 100 metres behind them just chatting it up as we do when we get together. And every time we'd turn a corner, someone would go, "Stop! Man, we can't have members of the public coming this way." And we were like, "We're with them. That's Jim's wife." And they're like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Please, please." And then they'd let us through. Then we'd walk for a while, and then they'd go, "Stop! You know, no unauthorized personnel past this point. We're with them." And it just kept happening. So, and then after the event, we went to dinner, and it was brilliant. Because Bill Clinton is a big fan of the Harriet Blue series. And we were all just about to get in the cars together. And he goes, I won't do my Bill Clinton impression, but I did a Bill Clinton impression for like two straight weeks afterwards. I couldn't stop doing it. I was doing it on the phone to everyone, but I won't do it now. But he said to me, "Oh, I love your book so much." And I was like, "Oh, thank you so much." And he said, "When's the next one out, Liar, Liar?" And I said, "It's out soon in Australia, but it's going to be a little while longer in the US. And he said, "Can you tell me what happens with that Regan Banks? Does she get him?" And I said, "Well, you're going to have to wait until the next book."
Oh, my God.
And then all the Secret Service around us are kind of going, "Who is this young upstart who's not telling him what he wants to know?" And he said, "Yeah, but you could just tell me, you know, is she gonna catch him? Does she go after him?" I said, "Mr. President, I can't give you a spoiler. You're just going to have to get the book." I was like, "I'll have it sent to you, but I'm not going to tell you." And all the Secret Service were like, "My God, who is this woman?" You know, and they were quite, you know, and he was like, "Oh, fair enough." You know, yeah. So then we went to dinner and we were just chatting about the books, and because he's written one with Jim, and I was like,
"Yeah,
we can commiserate on what a hard taskmaster he is," and all this sort of thing. And you know, I was just chatting to Jim about just life and stuff, a couple of wines, and it was great.
This is amazing.
Yeah, it was a great day.
You're set like a for life with that. Stories.
I know.
Like, what are you going to do next?
I don't know. It was a hell of a day.
I'm like blown away. Yeah. I feel like all I've said is, "Oh my God," for the last like that part, and then nearly dying, and then "Oh my God"
again. I don't
think
you've actually asked me any questions.
I'm just blown away.
Can you talk about this? Yes. Okay. Well, because I just, you can't shut me up.
I'm not stopping that story. When that story's going, I'm just sitting here and getting comfy and listening. That is phenomenal. Did you ever have moments of just, like, while it was happening, I'm like, "This is how did I get here?"
Yeah. One while I was in the car, I was in the car with Jim, and we were leaving because we were in the back of the arena, in the bowels of the arena. We all got in the cars, and the Secret Service was driving us and that, and we pulled out, and the cars got all tinted windows, and there were all these fans waiting there to have their book signs, and I was like, "Oh, I'm in the car that drives past, like I'm on this side of that," because I've waited outside for people to sign books and things. And then we got all the way to the hotel, and we were stopped in traffic just outside the doors to the hotel. We could just see them. We were two or three cars back, and Jim goes, "We could just get out here. I can see the hotel doors." And the Secret Service guy that was driving, he goes, "Sir, I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to see you through the doors of the hotel." And I said, "Surely if anyone shoots at us or something, you can just jump out of the car and come and jump in front of the bullet. Like, it's a couple of extra seconds. It'll be fine." And he was like, "Ma'am, I have one job. My job is to see you through the doors of the hotel. That's it."
I love how chill you are about it. Like, "Oh, it'll be right."
Yeah.
You look fast. No, you'll get there in time.
Well, I was kind of thinking, if somebody shoots at James Patterson, I'll dive in front of the bullet, and then that'll be like the best promo ever. Can you imagine that? Well, that would be on
provided every... you survive, it would be amazing.
Yeah. Well,
Or a year of the land of
What a way to go. Can you imagine the sales, though? I would take a hit for those sales.
Oh, my God.
Can you hear Bron back there snorting? I don't know. I would have to decide in that moment as I was flying through the air to, you know, in front of the, I would have to decide how I felt about it. But, look, I would give it a, I'd give it a red hot go.
Well, while I admire your courage, I really want to strongly suggest that you not jump in front of any bullets. It would make me very sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Candace, I don't even know where to go from there. Thank you so, so much for coming in. We've gone over time by a fair bit.
Yeah.
But there was
We always do this.
We always do. And it's always such a pleasure when you come and visit.
Oh, thank you.
One more question before we tie things off. I just want to ask... what's up next after Wailaia and when can we expect it?
So there is another Crimson Lake coming out. We're just having rambunctious battles over email about what we call it because now there's so many publishers involved. Everyone has to like the title. So we've almost settled on a title, but that's next. That's early next year will be another Crimson Lake.
Cool.
And then there's other stuff coming from Jim and I.
Awesome. Other non-Harry stuff?
I don't know. Something.
You're not allowed to say.
But we're just working on things. We're working on stuff. I'm just going to drop that. Just sprinkle that little...
Oh, my gosh.
...intriguing note in
so
there.
So good at doing that.
And then also, I don't know if you know, but the rights, the TV and film rights to Never Never have been bought.
I did not know that.
Yep. And then also Crimson Lake is in development.
Is there like dates for when these things are coming?
No,
they're still in production.
The TV and film world takes so much longer. But Crimson Lake is further along than Never Never. Uh-huh. But they're both with very strong production companies, and they're doing what they do. I'm not really involved. They're going to call me into the writers' room, both of
them.
When
it gets to that point.
When it gets to that point, but.
I'm going to be so opinionated about the casting.
Same. Yeah. But, yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
So much to look forward to.
Yeah.
Candace Fox, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I hope that you'll come visit us again soon.
Sure.
And everyone listening, you can get Liar Liar by James Patterson and Candace Fox and all of other Candace's books at Booktopia at www.booktopia.com.au.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.